Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of Deckard and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Well, many states are rushing to try to redraw districts following last month's decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to toss out a Louisiana congressional map that had two black majority districts. The move makes it harder to challenge redistricting plans as discriminatory under the Voting Rights Act. Atiba Ellis is a professor of law and associate dean for enrichment and engagement at Case Western Reserve University School of Law, nationally noted voting rights scholar. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Professor, as Ryan profiled last month, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its long-awaited decision in Louisiana versus Calais, which has fundamentally reshaped the legal landscape governing the Voting Rights Act and redistricting. Can you tell us more about this decision?
Sure. So, in Calais, the Supreme Court held, the technical holding was that in order to state a violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, you have to show that there was intentional, purposeful discrimination by a legislature where, in this case, they're drawing congressional districts in Louisiana to grant a second majority black district. So there are a lot of words there, and let me unpack them really quickly. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, and it was meant to remedy the country's long history of racial discrimination in voting. And then one of the ways discrimination can happen is in drawing electoral districts to either concentrate minority groups in an area where they wouldn't have as much influence as they could, or to split up groups. You know, the latter is called packing. This is, or you can crack, as in break up groups. So a federal district court in Louisiana found that the Louisiana legislature had packed black voters into one majority district and that the remedy ought to be create a second district. The Calais plaintiffs, who identified themselves as Louisiana voters who were not African American, basically said that thinking uses race consciousness, right? Giving people a remedy because of their race, they argued, violated the Constitution, and the court agreed with them. And they were reasoning based on recent decisions like Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard. And the court specifically pointed to this case called City of Mobile versus Bolden to basically say, well, if we're doing this under the 15th Amendment of the Constitution, which ultimately is the constitutional guarantee against racial discrimination in voting, that you have to show purposeful intent, evidence on the record that they were doing this because of race. So the court basically said, this is the way to understand how Section 2 ought to work, which in essence throws out decades of case law, which basically said all you have to do is look at the effect of a district. You don't have to ask about its intent. Were voters harmed? But now we have to show that were voters harmed and was it on purpose?
So, Professor, the court seemed to say in plain terms that racial gerrymandering is no longer constitutional, but partisan gerrymandering is fine. Is that an oversimplification of this decision?
I mean, let me give a little more nuance to that, right? I think the court had always outlawed racial gerrymandering in and of itself. If you want to play technical terms, right, there's this Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act remedy, which is statutory, but then there's also, under the Constitution, under the 14th Amendment, starting with a case called Shaw v. Reno from the mid-90s. This was technically called a racial gerrymandering claim. And the court says you can't use race to predominate how you draw electoral districts. So that's always been illegal. What's interesting here is that with Calais, right, it becomes very difficult to meet the standard under the Voting Rights Act. It is similarly difficult under Shaw, but in Ruccio versus Common Cause from back in 2019, I believe, the court said there's no, you know, claims of partisan gerrymandering are non-justiciable in the federal courts. Right. You can't even bring a claim because Chief Justice Roberts, in that opinion, said there's no judicially manageable standards by which partisan gerrymandering claims could be adjudicated in the federal court. So it's basically out of the power of the federal constitution. Depending on what state you are in, there might be remedies for partisan gerrymandering, but not federal remedies. So what we're seeing now is states saying, well, yes, maybe, and as we've seen, right, Louisiana, Tennessee, Virginia, Alabama have all rushed to redraw their districts, and they're basically saying it's for partisan reasons, Your Honor. And because the federal courts don't have remedies for that, and states may or may not have remedies for that, they're allowed to proceed.
So, Professor, to your point just now about the redrawing or attempts to redraw before midterm elections across multiple states, there are a number of constraints, including the Purcell principle. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So the Purcell principle comes from this case, which interestingly enough was about voter ID laws from the late 2000s, called Purcell versus Gonzalez. The Purcell principle, put plainly, is federal courts should not pass judgments that come too close to an election that it would interfere with that election, like imposing a new rule that creates confusion or demanding a requirement, you know, where people might not have had time to prepare for it, right? The court hasn't said too much about what the Purcell principle means, but we've seen over the past decade in particular in a lot of the shadow docket litigation, especially during the COVID period, where the court is saying, well, notwithstanding whether this rule is correct or not, the court entered a judgment too close to the election, and therefore we're throwing this out or putting it on hold. So it does run a Purcell risk, because in a number of these states, elections are already taking place. Some of them, early voting has already happened. And so you're seeing some governors having to put a pause on an election in order to pass a new district. This arguably is a constraint. That said, the court in recent days has either instituted orders or granted the judgment in Calais itself, all to allow its order to take effect immediately. So it looks like the court itself isn't actually holding faith with Purcell. And as my friend and colleague Rick Hazen argued in an op-ed a little while back, there, you could even give the mandate, but say it applies to the next election, arguably. But it doesn't. But it looks like the court wants this to take effect immediately.
Professor, last question. We really appreciate you coming on. What's next? I mean, for proponents of voting rights, do they have any strategies, given that this is a Supreme Court decision, after all, from this point?
Right. So one of the interesting things about election law, and I like to tell my students, always remember election law federalism. There's the federal courts, then there are the state courts. Sure, there might not be federal remedies now for racial gerrymandering, but a number of states have passed state-level voting rights acts. The constitutionality of those might be the very next front of litigation. Some states have anti-partisan gerrymandering provisions in their constitutions. You know, this can be dealt with in that form as well. And ultimately, there's still parts of the Voting Rights Act that still matter, right? Language discrimination provisions, anti-voter intimidation provisions, the sheer question of whether private parties can bring claims. There's more to come. But this isn't to understate that Calais hasn't, as I said to a friend earlier, this is a once in a century decision. And some people think it is the best for the federal courts to get out of this business or to make the standard this high. And for some, they're seeing representation being taken away at rates that last happened during Jim Crow. So, but this is to play out. And certainly the outcome of the elections in November will shape this even further.
We'll have to wait and see how that all turns out. Professor Atiba Ellis, thanks so much for coming on with us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at Deckard LLP and global co-chair of the firm's intellectual property practice. She has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers and Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. For more than 150 years, Deckard has advised the innovators who move industries forward. From the railroad pioneers of the 19th century to the world's top asset managers today, Deckard helps leaders uncover opportunity and unlock advantage. If you would like to learn more about Christina Martini and Deckard, visit Deckard.com.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to Legal Face-Off at WGNRadio.com. We've got a story about two billionaires battling over the development of artificial intelligence they both helped to create. Jill Fish is a distinguished professor of business law at University of Pennsylvania and has written more than 100 scholarly articles and book chapters that appeared in top law reviews, including the Harvard Law Review, Yale Law Journal, University of Pennsylvania Law Review, and Texas Law Review. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for that very flattering introduction. I don't think I deserve it, but pleasure to be here.
We appreciate it. Before we get into some of the nuances of the trial, maybe you could explain, Professor, to our viewers and listeners, what exactly is being litigated and why this case has actually gone to trial?
Well, I've been asking myself that question because Elon Musk's theory of the case, how he claims that he's entitled to some sort of judgment, has fluctuated, I think, from the initial complaint through the pleadings and even over the course of the trial. So it's hard to know what the case is really about. I have heard some, you know, commentary suggesting that Musk is motivated in part by competitive concerns, right? SpaceX is about to go public. OpenAI is one of its big competitors. And is this a way of, you know, making SpaceX look good or making Sam Altman and OpenAI look bad? And is there some sort of business motivation? Or is this, and I think a lot of the viewers that are watching this trial or listening to this trial are thinking, is this just the Silicon Valley tech bros kind of fighting it out in public?
So there's this allegation that in 2015, ChatGPT started as a nonprofit startup and that it evolved into something different. What should OpenAI's, if there was this original nonprofit mission, should it matter if it changed? I mean, what's the legal theory behind that evolution if that did, in fact, if that can be proven?
So Musk's legal theories are that either this is a breach of contract or a breach of fiduciary duty. And, you know, while there are fact questions and a jury is going to have to sort through some of the facts, I think either of those cases would be pretty hard to make based on what we've seen up until this point. The Musk's complaint talks a lot about a founding agreement, about some sort of contract, but there really isn't any contract. There isn't any formal document in this case. Musk is relying on, you know, communications, emails, conversations. Contract law requires formalities. It requires something more. With respect to fiduciary duty, nonprofits don't owe a fiduciary duty to their donors. Fiduciary duty issues are addressed by the state, by state attorneys general. And in this case, the state of California and the state of Delaware have both signed off on what OpenAI is doing. And the third thing that I would say is that there's no commitment for any kind of business, whether it's a nonprofit, a for-profit corporation, or OpenAI is now partly a public benefit corporation. There's no commitment to retain that same structure. Structure is different from mission. And I think it would be, you know, hard to argue that OpenAI's primary mission, which is to develop artificial intelligence and to do it in a responsible manner, that that's really changed.
Does corporate governance law adequately handle the power concentrated in these AI companies?
So, great question. Corporate governance law doesn't really deal with the concentration of power to a degree that is handled by antitrust law, but we don't have any good rules for, with respect to developing AI, what kind of business structure you have to use or whether you're abusing that business structure simply by being a powerful entity. And I think one takeaway from the trial is the role of a few key individuals could be critical, not just to the development of AI, but how it's deployed.
Professor, a lot of the evidence that we've seen so far derives from emails, many of which are old, founder conversations. I mean, that is typical in many trials that we deal with, but maybe not that typical in these kind of trials. But, you know, usually there is more evidence when you're dealing with breach of fiduciary duties and contractual law. What do you think of what we've seen so far and whether these will convince a jury that they were enforceable obligations many years later?
Well, as I said, I think it's going to be very hard to make the case that the emails and conversations rise to the level of enforceable obligations. It's going to depend on facts. It's going to depend on whether the jury finds there was an actual agreement. But one of the challenges is we don't know exactly what that agreement was, what its terms were. In essence, Elon Musk is saying, I don't like the way Sam Altman decided to run OpenAI. And it's not clear, even if there was some sort of contract, that a disagreement about policy would be a breach of that contract. But that's also why contract law requires formalities. So you can put your finger on what exactly was the agreement and understand whether there was a breach.
Professor, does the court have the power to actually force OpenAI to change or maybe pause its corporate structure?
Well, that's the other thing, is the remedies that Elon Musk is seeking in this case are really quite extraordinary. Even if the court or the jury were to find sufficient facts to constitute a breach of contract or a breach of some sort of duty, or maybe the best way to characterize this is a kind of mission drift, damages would be the normal remedy in this situation, not a court stepping in and trying to restructure OpenAI or decide who's going to run the company.
Do you think that, however this trial turns out, it could open a door for regulators or legislators to push for broader AI regulation?
Well, it's kind of funny, but I was thinking about that this morning and thinking, you know, this might be sort of counterproductive from Elon Musk's perspective, right? To the extent that he's doing this to sort of promote SpaceX and to promote his own control over the development of AI, it could be the case that regulators take a look at the mudslinging in the trial and they say, you know, we've got to take this a little bit more seriously. We can't leave these decisions in the hands of these particular individuals.
We've seen some interesting clashes between these individuals, you know, very high profile founders, one of whom, I guess, is in China right now with the president on his Chinese summit. How influential, I know you're not really, you know, perhaps a juror expert, but how influential do you think the personal testimony of these two individuals will be versus some of the other evidence that we've seen? I mean, jurors are frequently are swayed by, testimony, especially of high profile individuals. How much stock do you put on this back and forth that we've seen at trial so far, including the fact that the judge had to reprimand, these parties and only stick to the questions asked rather than go on these long diatribes that we've heard reports of?
Well, I think in terms of the personalities, certainly from Elon Musk's perspective, but even from Sam Altman's, that's probably not anything new. But I suspect the members of the jury feel like they're really lucky to be in the courtroom and hearing that testimony live and getting to see these individuals in person.
Well, Professor Jill Frisch, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to Legal Faceoff, celebrating 11 years of legal commentary excellence. Two Illinois Republican state senators are teaming up with legislation aimed at protecting kids from social media. Sue Rezin is one of those lawmakers. She's represented Illinois' 38th district since 2010.
So, Senator, please explain why you and Senator Harris introduced this legislation.
Yeah, well, we drafted these proposals because the digital world is changing much faster than our already existing laws. And parents are doing everything that they possibly can to help protect their children from the negative harm of social media platforms. So I've been working on a package of bills along with Senator Harris for almost 5 years now to implement and make sure that we have the guardrails in place to protect minors from the negative impact of the social media platform.
So let's jump in and explain to our listeners and viewers the elements, because there's actually four separate bills. Can you explain briefly what each of these bills would do?
Sure. Well, the Social Media Age Restriction Act, which is Senate Bill 4046, which is one of my many bills that I have that limit social media access for children under 16. So it's an outright ban for social media, much like the ban that Australia just passed. There's also other countries that have some form of a ban for minors, and states also have passed legislation that have some form of ban for social media platform for minors as well, or they may have chosen to go the parental consent route. But again, we are trying to put guardrails in place to protect minors.
I know it's early, for example, with some of these other countries, but have you seen any data, information on how these bans have so far affected these other countries?
Well, again, I mean, Australia just passed their outright ban. The European Union is debating this topic as we speak. The countries and our states are trying to figure out a pathway forward that doesn't impinge on our First Amendment rights, but still protects minors from the harmful effects of social media. We may not get it perfect the first time, but it is incredibly important that we try, because we are seeing the effects from minors with increased mental health problems and increased anxiety. We hear about it from teachers in their classrooms. This is a real issue, and it's incumbent upon us at the state level, at the federal level, like we're seeing in other countries, to try to find a pathway forward that makes sense.
All right. So, Senator, you talked about the outright ban. What other elements of this legislation can you explain to us, please?
So I also have a better Social Media Feeds Act, which provides better algorithms for that are presented to minors. Currently, the algorithms are written to addict and keep the minors on the platform, and they're seeing content that they didn't ask to see. We're saying that this should be a longer, better experience if minors are allowed on platforms, much like if you sign up for a streaming app and you go into your profile and you are asked all of these questions. What are your interests? What are your hobbies? What kind of what kind of programs would you like to see? This is a longer better process, better experience for the viewer. We are saying, especially for minors, if they are allowed to be on social media platform, the algorithms need to reflect their interest, what they like to see, not what the tech companies want them to see. That short-term gratification is currently built into our social media platforms, which tries to addict the minors to the platform, regardless of whether they requested to see the content or not, because the tech company's purpose is to keep the minor on the platform for as long as possible. Why? Because they're collecting data, and data is valuable. That's the bottom line. They're taking the data from the miners and they're selling that data. We say that the algorithms have to be rewritten, not to addict miners to the platform, but to create an experience, a long-standing experience that's much, much better for the miner should they be allowed to be on the platform. We also have an age-appropriate design code. This bill, I'm working with national advocacy groups, is much like the bill that was passed in California, to make sure that, again, the data miners' data privacy is protected, and we create a healthy environment for minors. And then also Senator Harris has a bill that requires age verifications for adult websites to prevent minors from accessing this kind of content. We all agree that there should be boundaries in place, that minors should not be able to access adult content. But you would be surprised with the pushback that we as legislators who are presenting these bills receive by the tech companies. We're always challenged. Once we pass legislation, their typical plan is they sue us in court and the bills go through the court system, which is fine. We are happy ultimately to find a pathway forward that does not infringe or impede our First Amendment right, protects our rights, but also protects minors from content that they should not be seeing.
So you must be emboldened by recent verdicts that are basically finding the same thing that you're speaking about, right? That the big tech companies are engaged in activities where they are trying to optimize engagement and maximize these addictive features so that they keep people, especially youth, on the platform more. It's essentially, these juries are essentially doing what you're talking about. Is that true?
Well, there's no question. So the reason that we have these addictive features on our platform, especially for minors, is because, again, they're collecting data and they're selling the data. This is their business model. This is how the tech companies make money. Statistics show that if you addict a minor by the age of 13 to your platform, that they will be addicted to your platform. We're sending the wrong message because the minors are seeing content that they have no business seeing. They did not request to see the content, but because of the business strategy for the company, they have features such as autoplay, infinite scrolling. These features are designed to keep minors engaged and on the platform. Now, mind you, their brains are not fully developed. Oftentimes, they do not understand what they're seeing or cannot critically think through the content that they're seeing, which creates a whole list of mental health issues and anxiety. So it's important that we look and prohibit some of these features or all of the features for the minors to make sure that they're not addicted to the platforms, because they can't understand oftentimes what they're seeing. They view the content more as black and white. And also, the more that they see that content, the more that they believe it, because they're not critically thinking through the content that you and I may see and understand that's fake or that, you know, that's not real. They are not at the age where they can understand that yet. So it's incredibly important that we make sure that we are putting in bumpers in place to make sure that the content that they're seeing is, first of all, requested and age appropriate.
Senator, you mentioned the First Amendment. How do you reconcile freedom of expression, freedom of speech with these bumpers that you just described?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, we support the First Amendment. We want to protect speech. It's incredibly important. However, there are many instances where we have in the past said that minors, we need to protect minors from certain things such as alcohol and tobacco and other substances that they do not and should not engage in. So there is precedence in the past, being able to look at what the biggest healthcare crisis, mental health crisis that we have for this generation. I think we all agree that it is the addiction to social media. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that, first of all, we pass legislation that passes the First Amendment test, but there will be pathways as many of these bills go through the legal system that judges will opine on that give us a pathway to make sure that we can protect minors while yet at the same time protect our First Amendment rights.
Senator, how do you answer the criticism, which I'm sure you've heard over the last 5 years, that this is a case of government overreach where parental responsibility should primarily be the answer for this problem?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a strategy of the tech companies. I have been to numerous national conferences and attended panels on this topic. This is the question for a legislator of this generation. How do we solve this problem? And almost every time I listen to, actually, every time I listen to the representative of the tech companies who are speaking on the panel, that is their business model. They say it is the parents' responsibility to watch and appropriately monitor what their children are looking at. And that is true. There's some responsibility by the parents, I agree, as a parent of four kids. But parents are being asked to manage very complex systems with algorithms that they don't even know how they're written to addict their minor to the platform. Now, because of the pressure that we at the state level are trying to pass bills and create pressure to make the tech companies do the right thing, a few of the companies have said that we have implemented a program that gives the power to the parents to make sure that they are appropriately monitoring their minor, which I say is great. I say it's about time because we've been talking about this now for well over a decade. And the only reason that you see large companies start to implement these protections is because we are forcing them to implement them. The problem becomes, though, that these are algorithms that are created. We don't know the algorithms. We don't know how they're written. They're not transparent. So you have a team at a company that's asking us, trust us. We have a plan in place to make sure that the algorithms are written and our programs written to protect the minors. But when or if, because we haven't passed state legislation, their competition has not passed the same thing, it's possible for them to roll back on their pledge and write and loosen up the algorithms to once again allow minors to see content that they should not be seeing. That's why it's incumbent at the state level for legislators to pass the bills. There's well over 300 bills, if not more, teed up across the entire country trying to deal with this issue and force the tech companies to come to the table and do what's right. I can sleep at night because I've been working on this issue to protect minors. If you talk to your teachers, the frustration, the mental health, the anxiety is incredibly prevalent in our schools. The terrible, tragic stories that parents tell about their children who have been exposed to content that they had no idea existed, and they've done, you know, terrible things, whether it's self-harm or taken their life. The stories are tragic. So, you know, I could sleep at night because I'm going to continue to push these bills. And once they're passed, if I'm challenged in the court of law, I welcome it. My hope is that they will create a pathway. The judge will create a pathway for legislators like me who really want to do the right thing to protect the minors and give us a pathway that looks right so we can pass legislation that protects our First Amendment right and also allows us to do what we're trying to do in our legislation.
State Senator Sue Resin, thanks for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag. On today's edition, we bring in David Ring, a plaintiff's personal injury trial lawyer with Taylor Ring, where he works with survivors of sexual abuse and assault. He's based out of L.A. Thanks for joining us, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
And in this corner, Justin Kaufman of Axios, political reporter, writer, more than 25 years working in Chicago media, TV, radio, print, digital, you name it, he's covered it. Justin, welcome.
Just rolls off the tongue, Ryan.
Does. It really does. All right. Well, we start here. Even though he's in China right now,
China.
The Trump watch never stops today, Rich. We're talking about the paint job underway right now with reflecting bull. My son is in eighth grade. He went on his eighth grade trip, was there last week. He saw them beginning that paint job, and now there's a lawsuit for it.
Yeah, I mean, thank God that there are no more important things to worry about in this country aside from the various improvements and renovations that the president is engaged in. I mean, literally down to the color of the paint and faucets and this kind of stuff. Yeah, there's a new lawsuit that was brought forward trying to halt. This lawsuit was by the Cultural Landscape Foundation trying to halt, Tina, this renovation of the reflecting pool that Trump seems to think is really one of the top priorities this country is facing. He wants to paint it the American flag blue, he's calling it. And he awarded the contract in a no-bid contract that violates presumably all sorts of federal statutes. It's just basic common sense, right? When you're hiring a contractor, if anyone has ever hired a contractor, don't just give the job to one contractor. It's kind of a rule that apparently the president doesn't know. But it also, by the way, similar to the ballroom, which apparently was going to cost nothing to taxpayers, now is costing double because, as he said to what he called a stupid reporter yesterday, it's now going to cost double. Similarly, this contract was originally going to cost, what, $1.8 million. It's now ballooned, Tina, to seven times that. It's a $13 million job now. So, you know, this lawsuit seeks to halt him from doing that. This is supposed to be done, again, basic common sense and, you know, law, consistent with a protocol where you go through Congress, Congress appropriates the money, you choose among various contractors. Trump did none of this, so that's why we have this lawsuit.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, this is, like I would say, consistent with the playbook that's been established. As you said, there is a protocol and a process for this. I think, you know, this sort of fallback position that there are exigent circumstances that are creating an emergency to justify the bucking of the process, I guess the lesson I take from all this is if I wait long enough for something, when it, even if it is an emergency now, it becomes an emergency if you wait long enough. So, I mean, this is just more of the same, right? So I can't say I'm surprised by any of this.
Yeah, Dave, to Tina's point, the administration's explanation for going this way was because of the exigent circumstances and the emergency repair needed for the country's 250th birthday. Hey, newsflash, you've had 250 years notice of this event. How is that an emergency?
Oh, boy. Look, it's another example of an end run around procedures and rules. And you know, what they're banking on is, hey, this thing's going to be painted and done before any lawsuit has any effect on anything. You know, the lawsuit is just filed. They're halfway done with it. I mean, what would really be interesting is if some judge put a halt to it and half of the pool is painted blue and the other half isn't. That would be an interesting 250th celebration.
Yeah. I mean, Justin, the administration said they chose this contractor, again, no bid contract, because they had worked on his swimming pools at his golf club in Virginia.
Yeah. Well, you know, as somebody in Chicago, I mean, we deal with national historical sites and preservation all the time. Could you imagine if the Ricketts decided that they were just going to redo Wrigley Field without going through the processes and all the things they had to do, even though they own the stadium and they own the team, they still had to follow procedures and protocols and laws to make sure that it was in line with the preservation. The same with Soldier Field here in Chicago. That's been a big issue. The museum campus, it's why the Bears can't just build a dome without getting everybody on board. So, I mean, as mentioned, it is very strange that the president of the United States and someone, you know, a huge, you know, executive branch wouldn't understand that you'd need to go through the rules and regulations of national historic preservations and landmarks. But here we are.
Don't know too many presidents who have been hiring contractors. If you go back, that's an interesting thing that I didn't know that they did. I mean, of course you can, but hey, and I just want to put this on your radar for Trump watches in the future. Fed Chair Kevin Warsh, the nominee, has just been confirmed by the Senate. So I'm sure we'll be talking about that down the road for various other things that come up. All right, moving along, two police officers say Matt Damon and Ben Affleck have caused them harm and ruined their reputations by portraying them in the Netflix crime drama The Rip. Rich, what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, this movie was on Netflix. I mean, I don't know. I watched it. It was kind of hard to watch. Not a great movie. But the allegation in this lawsuit is that the story was based on these two officers. It's basically a story about some corrupt police officers who steal some money that's being counted after it was seized by a narcotics team. And these two cops, Miami-Dade Sheriff's Office, Tina, say that the story is basically based on an experience they had, and they were defamed by the story because, you know, it portrays them as dirty cops. It's important to know they are not named in the movie. There aren't, you know, even, I mean, they don't even look. I saw these guys yesterday. They don't look like Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, even though those are two good-looking guys. Importantly, the film says that it's what's the word they use? It's loosely based on or inspired by true events, right? That's an important term because I think you can use that term and, you know, be fairly creative with your you know, how you portray people. But in this case, I don't even think it's close because I don't know, aside from knowing these two individuals and knowing that they were involved in maybe a similar circumstance many years before, back in 2016, there's no way the general public would confuse these two actors with these two individuals, in my opinion.
I agree, Rich, and trying, and it's a very high bar. We've seen similar cases to this over our years together on LFO. We're trying to prove the harm and to meet the burden of proof in these kinds of cases, especially when you're not mentioning people specifically. I think this is going to be a really tough case for them to prove.
Right. And Justin, I mean, you know, we frequently talk about the two different issues when you file a lawsuit, right? Liability and damages. And even if they prove liability, which is really an uphill battle, as Tina mentioned, what are their damages, right? I mean, the general public has no idea who they are. So
they want a disclaimer. I was reading that story. They want the film to put a disclaimer on. I don't know enough about Hollywood law, if that's a thing, about when you're dealing with most stories are inspired by true events. And we've seen a million movies and a lot of characters that are villains in movies. Do they have the right and any recourse when it comes to, you know, saying, hey, you did not portray me in a light that is good. That's going to hurt my reputation. I'm never getting hired again, whatever it might be. But I don't know. Is that a thing that Hollywood has to deal with? Because you'd think that they'd clear all that stuff before they'd actually do a movie.
Yeah, look, they're proceeding on a claim of defamation by implication. Very, very, very difficult claim to win on. But their argument is, hey, there's enough people in Miami and in law enforcement who, when they see the movie, they go, that is those two guys, because those are the two guys involved in it. But again, I don't think that's going to be enough to carry the day for them. It's very, very uphill climb for them to win this type of lawsuit.
Yeah, Rich, you know, I'm intrigued because I think of Ryan Murphy, who does the real Hollywood story type shows like, you know, about Monica Lewinsky or the Menendez brothers or whatever. Did they have a claim to say, hey, that's, you know, like that's not how it happened. That makes me look bad. I would like to sue Netflix or FX or Ryan Murphy. I mean, that's what I don't understand. There has to be some sort of clause and you guys know better than I about, you know, what is protected when you get to the point of making a movie about a true event.
Well, thankfully, I'll turn this over to one of the foremost intellectual property attorneys around, but there's a right of publicity, basically, that you're talking about that Tina could give you kind of a better explanation of.
Yeah, I mean, we're touching on this whole right of publicity issue throughout a lot of our grab bag topics today and often do, but the gist is, you know, you have to get permission, for example, when it comes to a film, when it comes to even pictures of celebrities that you're using and distributing, particularly for a commercial use. You have to be mindful that there's layers of rights to these sorts of things beyond just who owns the photograph, who's creating a screenplay. You need to be mindful that celebrities have a right of publicity that is particularly a creature of state statute, but you need to just be careful about it because this is how people get in trouble, for example, on Instagram, you know, publishing pictures, even people, you know, publishing pictures of themselves. You just have to be careful about the layers of rights, including right of publicity. You need people's permission because if it's a commercial use, you're presumably making something, money and other things off of somebody's renown. So, and there's also something known as the right of privacy. Right to privacy is something that more the common folk like me and Rich have a right to. We're not celebrities, even though we like to think we are. So, I don't know if that answers your question, Justin, but, you know, it's a basic principle that, you know, sometimes there are exceptions and extenuating circumstances. It's very fact specific, but that's a general principle.
And she's teed up what our next conversation is. By the way, this is the most Tina story we've ever had. It's got Taylor Swift. It's got trademarks. Tina, Billboard has gone through all of the words and symbols that Taylor Swift has trademarked over the years.
We could seriously have five shows just to go through the list of trademarks that Taylor owns. But this is a really interesting story because a lot of folks have probably seen that other celebrities, including Matthew McConaughey, Beyonce, Justin Bieber, are really sort of getting publicity around being more proactive in protecting their what I would call elements of their celebrity. And they're doing that through intellectual property. We covered this story a number of years ago when Taylor Swift had re-recorded her catalog and then eventually bought back her original masters. But in any event, Taylor Swift owns over 150 trademarks. She doesn't own trademarks in everything she's filed for. She's filed for over 300, has gotten about 150. And it's really for the purpose of trying to protect herself against people using album names, different phrases like Swiftie, Swiftmas, Taylor's version. And it's really for the purpose of trying to make it easier to enforce against what I would call bad actors, people who either, you know, try to create merchandising, some of which is either counterfeit merchandising, the type of which you would expect to see at like a concert, But, you know, we covered recently the Swift home betting line. And so, you know, it's for the purpose of trying to facilitate her ability to stop people from trying to take advantage of her renown. Sometimes, as we've seen, Rich, she's on the other side of these types of battles. You know, she recently tried to trademark The Life of a Showgirl and then ended up encountering issues because of the Las Vegas performer Maren Wade, who owns the phrase purportedly in Confessions of a Showgirl and now is involved in a trademark infringement suit. But, you know, there's also the trying to trademark voice and likeness as well, which is becoming particularly important in the advent and given that we're in the AI age where there's just more cases. Like there's an avatar case that just was recently publicized, Rich, about somebody, about Cameron, James Cameron being sued for using part of somebody's face for the purposes of creating the avatar. And so this is a really interesting area. AI is making things a lot more fun, at least in my neck of the woods.
Yeah, I mean, all of it has changed given AI and you know, the most recent filings the last couple of weeks were basically two recordings of her voice saying it's Taylor, it's Taylor Swift, and then an image of her holding a guitar during her last tour. You know, she was the victim of some deepfakes online. I think that's motivating a lot of these new filings. But yeah, the question of whether you could like trademark your voice is really kind of new and would really expand some of these protections. But I think it is a growing trend. We saw Matthew McConaughey, you know, try to do this with his, you know, all right, all right, all right, famous quote from Dazed and Confused. But Dave, do you see this trend continuing? I mean, certainly if she's successful, you'll see hundreds, thousands of artists follow suit, I assume.
Absolutely. I mean, look, I think it's a brilliant move by her. She's a brilliant businesswoman. And what she's doing is it's aggressive brand protection. She is protecting her brand by obtaining all of these trademarks. Most of them, she's successful in obtaining. Some of them, she doesn't get. But she has enough where she can go out there and enforce trademark infringements. And AI is really, really, really going to be, this is going to be cutting edge stuff in the next coming years, which is exactly why she's gotten a trademark on her voice and certain phrases and things like that. So it's a fascinating area of law that's coming down the pike.
Well, it ruins, Rich, it ruins our idea for a t-shirt of just 1989. I was going to get that t-shirt just said 1989 or Shake It Off. Or look what made you, what you made me do. Like we could do, we just ruins our idea of all these counterfeit t-shirts we could get.
She owns many of those.
All right, let's stick with pop stars and lawsuits. This one involving Dua Lipa. She's going after Samsung, the South Korean electronics manufacturer, because she says her image was used on their TV boxes. Tina.
Yeah, Ryan. So, of course, I'm handling this one as well. So last week, Dua Lipa filed a lawsuit against Samsung in California, claiming that the company took a copyrighted image of her face and started using it on their television boxes. She claimed she didn't offer her permission or get any compensation. Apparently, she was able to readily link this image of herself back to a photo that was taken at the 2024 Austin City Limits Festival. She claims that she owns it and she's alleging copyright and trademark infringement and a violation of her right of publicity. Apparently, you know, she says that when you look at social media posts, that using her image on these TV boxes is apparently boosting sales. There's some fans that are claiming that they actually looked into and purchased these TVs, particularly given that being fans, they noticed her image and thought that she was somehow, you know, sponsoring or endorsing this brand of television. She's seeking $15 million in damages. Samsung claims that they were provided with the consent through a third-party content partner which we've covered cases like this before, Rich, as well. But they're saying that they got the permission from this content provider and received assurances that all necessary permissions had been secured. And on this basis, they're denying any intentional misuse. I mean, I think, Rich, in this instance, obviously, it's very fact specific. She claims she never offered permission. They're saying that they got the necessary permissions. It really looks like it's one of those situations where if the content provider didn't have the layers of approvals they needed, it's a pretty easy case, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question. If it's simply a question of a document or a contract and whether it's authentic or not, that's not really newsworthy for us. But what is newsworthy is if there's not, and there's somehow they're alleging that they had use the likeness of one of the most prominent musicians in the world to sell TVs. That's crazy. And I think $15 million is like a bargain. I mean, I wouldn't be asking for 10 times that. I mean, listen, if you're walking through Best Buy or Costco and you're looking at TVs and you look at the one with Dua Lipa, I mean, Dua Lipa is a very attractive person and she's, spent a decade or more building that brand. That will attract you. There's no question. So $15 million is actually a bargain, I think. So, yeah, I mean, if there's a document that, out there, but who knows? But presumably they wouldn't be pursuing this lawsuit if it was as simple as this document exists. Right, Justin?
Well, Dua Lipa is not an independent artist. she's has a monster record label and management team and all these people around her. So I could plausibly understand if somebody went to try and get rights from one of the arms of the Dua Lipa mega corporation that supports this artist. I could understand that. But, the idea at the end of the day, you can't really do a no harm, no foul in this case, because they're selling a TV with her likeness on it. So regardless if they got permission and it wasn't the right kind of permission or they just didn't, I think they're going to be liable either way, because you can't, if they're saying, no, this wasn't enough, there's proof that the TV was sold because Dua Lipa was on the cover.
Dave, many years ago here in Chicago, Michael Jordan went to trial because a local grocery chain had been using his likeness to sell coupons without his permission. And he actually, he rejected all attempts to settle, went to trial and won. And that's, 20 years ago. I mean, your image is your whole brand and it shouldn't be used without your permission, period.
Period. Name, image, and likeness. If you're famous, you're a celebrity, you get to control your name, image, and likeness. If you don't want to be on a Samsung TV box and they put a photo of you on there and they make a lot of sales because of that, that's going to be problems for Samsung. She's going to probably win this case, and as she should. I mean, they had no authority to put her likeness on the box and try to trick people into thinking she was endorsing this type of TV. So I'm with her 100% on this.
Tina, I have to jump in here as the IP lawyer, because I've dealt with these issues before and I've seen instances, whether this is one of them or not, where a famous person has their people, including their lawyers, dealing with licensing agencies. And there are instances where permission is granted by the people who are part of the entourage of the famous people, and they just aren't aware of it. So, hopefully this is a more coordinated effort than that, but it's really, Samsung's a very sophisticated company. So it just seems to me like there's something going on here that we may not be aware of. I just don't think that they're going to be slapping her picture on a box without some level of permission.
Right. Could there be an argument made, Tina, that the image on the box is the image of the TV, not the image on the TV, which is on the box?
Right.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
If her face is on there,
it's on the image of the TV, which is on the box, but the box is for the TV. I don't know. I don't think there's much there.
Creative, but I would say.
I think, Ryan, you should become Samsung's lawyer. That was good. That was
there.
Good.
You go. There you go. Well, I, it's funny that we're talking about it. You know, a musician that they, I bet they wouldn't dare mess around with like putting an NFL game image on there and, you know, risk that. They'd probably see, you know, that that lawsuit wouldn't be $15 million. That'd be, you know, $150 million. All right. Cubs and Wrigley View Rooftop continue to battle over the right to allow people to watch live sports from private property. Rich, this is actually in your neck of the woods. Can you flip the screen around? Can you see them?
I could see one of them across the street. I mean, it's intellectual property day here, as it often is. These stories are super interesting. I mean, in a way, this is, you know, a similar, I mean, at the end of the day, what we're talking about all these stories is using someone's rights without getting permission, using a valuable piece of property, be it your image, be it your name, be it a baseball product, without getting permission. And the allegation here, I mean, this goes back, what, 25 years, Justin, Ryan, you guys cover the story extensively, but the bottom line for these stories is that across the street from Wrigley Field, there have been for 100 years rooftops, right? And for many, many years, people would go and congregate on these rooftops and watch the game. There was no issue. It was part of the neighborhood. Well, the Cubs realized that there's value to this property called baseball, and rather than give it away for free, they decided to charge for that. Well, the rooftop owners didn't like that, and they had this litigation where the rooftop owners said, hey, this is our building. You knew that you were pulling a ballpark in the middle of a residential neighborhood. Too bad. The Cubs said, well, no, this is a product. You're consuming it. It's very valuable. We would otherwise sell this product to ticket payers or TV watchers. Therefore, you should pay. What do the Cubs do? They erected all sorts of obstacles, billboards, scoreboards to block the view. They parties litigated, and they came up with a solution, right? But in the 2020 or so, they came up with a deal where the Cubs would get a percentage of revenue. I think it was 17% from the rooftop owners in exchange for taking down these obstructions. Everyone was happy. Well, guess what? In 2023, the deal ended, right? And by then, the Ricketts, who owned the Cubs, had purchased most of the rooftops. There's one holdout. That brings us to this lawsuit. Tina, this one holdout says that, again, we get the right to do with our rooftop as we want. We continue to charge people to watch the game. The Cubs didn't like that, and there's this lawsuit. Last week, about 10 days ago, federal court judge here in Chicago said that the lawsuit can continue rather than dismiss it, the lawsuit by the rooftop against the Cubs. The judge said it could continue. And basically, she said there's at least an arguable question of fact for a jury to decide whether the Cubs have a right to protect this product or whether it's just out there in the ether and anyone can consume it beyond the walls of Wrigley. And there's case law involved. There's an old case from, you know, back in the day that says that you do have to pay for that. Ultimately, I think we're dealing with the same thing. I think the Cubs have a legitimate argument that this is a valuable product, more valuable than ever in this era of people paying premium for live events, that the rooftop should pay for. On the other hand, you could see some merit to the idea that this is in a neighborhood, a residential neighborhood. Why not charge someone walking by the stadium who hears a home run? Why not charge people who set up lawn chairs outside of Wrigley or Soldier Field when there's a Paul McCartney concert, right? Where does that kind of end? So, Tina, this is also in your wheelhouse. What do you think?
I mean, I definitely think that this, I think the Cubs have a really good argument that this is an enforceable intellectual property right. I think that it's one thing if this rooftop owner just decides to have people over sitting around watching the game. I think the big thing here is that they're making money off of it. They're selling tickets. I don't think it's a good fact for them that they were previously, they had a contract. They had an agreement with the Cubs. And it was a longstanding agreement that no longer exists. And they are still trying to continue to make money off of what is going on in the field, which is something that the Cubs own and have a right to enforce. So that's my two cents.
Dave, what do you think?
I think it comes down to a very simple legal concept, and it's called unjust enrichment. And the rooftop owner is making money off the backs of the Cubs, and they're not sharing and putting cost to put the Cubs on the field or the product on the field. They're just making money by charging people to watch the games. That's unjust enrichment. I think the Cubs have a legitimate argument here. They're probably going to win. I think the solution is going to be the Cubs are going to cut themselves a pretty good deal with the rooftop owner and get a bigger percentage of the profits and maybe have another deal in place for a few more years.
Justin, you have a cut.
I mean, this is a legal... Yeah, I mean, it's a legal podcast.
The Cubs are worth $5.25 billion with a B. Is this just bad, being a bad neighbor?
This is a legal podcast. So the legal argument is probably strong that the Cubs have. But culturally, and I think they need to be very sensitive to the fact that the neighbors around them, fans and everyone that enjoys the Chicago Cub product also enjoys the culture and the folklore around it, which includes the idea of Wrigley Field and the best park in the best city in Chicago, in the country. And you can see that this stadium is so different than everywhere else. It's kind of like Fenway. And so I completely understand why the Cubs would make a deal in 2020 to say, let's make this happen, because they were getting a lot of negative publicity at the time. A lot of people were like, why are you crunching down on these very small rooftop owners and gobbling them up? But in this case, and Tina nailed it. There's a big the rooftop owner wants to play in nostalgia, wants to play in folklore. But that's not, we all know in Chicago, that's not what they're doing. They've erected bleachers. They've put up, their food and drink packages. This is not, I'm giving $20 for my friend to come up and I got a couple seats up there. They're essentially creating a second bleachers for Wrigley Field. So when you see that, you're like, yeah, that's definitely a legal argument. But the folklore, when you're trying to win an argument, the Ricketts and any sports owner needs to recognize that greed is always on the table. And if they feel like they're trying to destroy something that is part of the folklore of Wrigley Field, it may not look good. And I think that's why they settled in 2020. And I'm surprised that they're not trying to make a deal, a revenue sharing deal in 2026, which would benefit both. But again, this rooftop owner is the holdout. The Ricketts bought the rest of they understand how lucrative it is. they're not tearing these down. They are saying, we'll take that money. So it's very interesting to me, because I think this is one of those areas where a legal story really splits down the middle to also be a cultural story, which the Cubs need to recognize.
Dave, are there any high elevation locations in LA where we can watch the Olympics without buying a ticket?
Well, I'll tell you what, if you're ever in LA and you go to a Dodger game, before you go there, if you go up Elysian Park, way up behind Dodger Stadium, it is one of the most fantastic views you'll ever see. And you're looking right down into Dodger Stadium, mm-hmm. and plenty of people go up there and try to see the game.
The Olympics will be at Dodger Stadium coming up in 2028. So there's an option for some people. All right. Lots of cruise ship news this week. We're not talking Hantavirus, however you want to pronounce it, unless you guys want to. This one is about a passenger cashing in big after getting overserved. What a deal that is. Tina, you threw this one into the bag.
Yeah, Ryan. So this is a Carnival cruise story. So there was a passenger who claimed that the ship's staff, in the span of 8 hours, served her over 14 tequila shots. She ended up getting awarded $300,000 in damages in a Florida federal court. She claims that after being overserved, that she fell down a flight of stairs and suffered severe injuries as a result of that fall. The jury determined that both Carnival as well as Diana Sanders, who's this individual, were negligent for the incident. They determined that the cruise line was 60% responsible. Carnival says they disagree with the verdict. They're planning on appealing. What's interesting, Rich, is we have covered these cases before. These are dram shop cases. We've also talked about how the very nature of what incapacitates somebody to have terrible judgment when it comes to deciding whether they've had enough to drink or drugs or whatever the inebriant may be. The very fact of the matter is that you've got folks who are serving these people who are given indications based on how she behaved, allegedly, that she was overserved. As a result, she ended up falling down these stairs. So it'll be interesting to see if Carnival actually ends up appealing this decision. Based on the information we've got, I'm not so sure that they would necessarily be successful, but I know you handle these kinds of cases. So,
I mean, the Hantavirus makes me not want to go on a cruise. And then I read this story. I'm like, sign me up. How quickly can I get on a cruise, get hammered,
on, you know, Cuervo and then get 300,000 on
the alcohol
top of it.
Kills the virus. It kills the virus. I mean, yeah, there you go.
It's really a win-win. I mean, yeah, you know, it's just ridiculous. I mean, I get Dram Shop. I deal with a lot of those cases, but I don't know. So maybe don't, I don't know, and I'm just kind of spitballing here, but maybe don't have 14 shots of tequila on the high seas. That's just one way to go, and maybe accept some personal responsibility rather than asking 12 people to give you $1 million because you got all effed up. Speaking of effed up, you got all effed up on a boat. I mean, come on. Stop it. Just stop it. And by the way, this wasn't her, there's lots of evidence that this wasn't her first rodeo. She's like a veteran drinker. Maybe just don't drink that much. We'll all be better off. Justin?
Well said. Well, no, I fall in the personal responsibility camp. I find it, it's got to be so hard for bartenders and for people involved to recognize and make the call. Because essentially when you say someone's overserved, which they have to do at some point, it gets belligerent. And so in a cruise environment, which is a vacation environment, it's probably really hard to suss that out. But the jury said what the jury said. So I don't know. I do tend to believe more in personal responsibility.
I'm going against you guys, you know, and here's why. Look,
I think I'm in a Dave camp.
I get it. Personal responsibility and all that. But this is a cruise ship that owes a duty of care to all of its passengers. And they know that certain passengers are going to get on there and they're going to drink too much. They're on a cruise. And the cruise is the one serving the drinks. And they have an absolute responsibility to say, you know what? You've had enough. You're not making correct decisions by doing shot number 12. And they have an obligation to cut them off. And if they don't, something bad usually happens. And usually it's something bad to an innocent person. Person overdrinks, gets in a car, leaves the bar, they've been overserved, and they kill an innocent person in a car accident. And that's why these laws are important. I know it's very difficult for all of us to sit there and say, hey, how did she get away with this? But you know what? Carnival Cruise, they have some responsibility in this. And I think the jury did it right when they kind of split the responsibility 60-40. I really do.
What's Carnival supposed to do? What are there, 600 people on a cruise, 1,000 people? What are they supposed to assign an alcohol monitor to each of them? I mean, she's going from bar to bar, presumably. The complaint said that she looked like she was staggering, slurring. I get all that. That's the complaint. Who knows what the evidence was? I saw this woman. She looks like she knows how to drink. This is not her first time having 14 shots. I'm sure she wasn't as, you know, drunk as she alleged, you know, drunk looking as she alleges. But it's putting a lot of responsibility on a bartender who's dealing with 60 people who are yelling for drinks to look at the person and think, oh, you look a little bit overserved. I'm not going to serve you. I mean, that's crazy.
It's not a little bit. It's a lot. They should be able to look at him and say they're falling down drunk. And that's the standard, is falling down drunk.
I mean, when's the last time you tried to get a drink at a busy bar? I mean, those people have like 2 seconds to even look at you. And they tried, by the way, they tried not to make eye contact, because if they did that, they wouldn't be able to serve anyone.
I get a lot of non-eye contact at the bar.
Yes.
I get that. I get that a lot. All right. On Legal Face Off, we like to give people tips on how to handle themselves in front of a judge, especially if you're online. We know that when talking to a judge on Zoom, you should be wearing pants. We've learned that in recent weeks. We've learned that you should not be talking to the judge while driving on a suspended license. And now a pretty good one. Don't cuss out the judge. Rich, take this one away for us.
Well, this is the greatest judge in the world. This is the same guy. How could it be? We just had this guy on, not on, but we had this video that you mentioned where that, you know, defendant in the driving case is clearly driving her vehicle. And this judge says, are you driving? She says, no, I'm being driven. And he says, how is that possible? I see the seatbelt. Well, guess what? This judge is back with another defendant. I love anytime a judge uses the word tough guy, it's great. This is the longest serving judge in this court. He's been on the court. And the court from 1998. Again, this guy's got to deal with a lot of crazy defendants. So I don't blame him. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's okay to use, you know, some interesting language, but not MF-er, right? I mean, even when you're on, people seem to lose control of their senses when they're on Zoom. And good for this judge to haul this guy in, Tina.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. This judge could have a weekly show just highlighting all of the losers that unfortunately he has to deal with. It just kind of reminds me of like when Judge Wapner got super stern on the People's Court, you know, with all the crazies that came into his courtroom. Right. So I don't know, maybe this guy could become the next, you know, Judge Wapner.
Love this guy. Dave, have you ever seen anything like this?
Tell you, I mean, I love how the judge handled it. You know, he didn't even bat an eye. If you keep watching the clip, he makes a Muhammad Ali reference at some point, saying, well, you're a tough guy. You fought Muhammad Ali, I bet. But you know, on the serious note, too, it shows the lack of decorum that we see a lot in courts nowadays, where not lawyers so much, but litigants, pro se litigants, they come in, they think they can say whatever they want, do whatever they want. It can be really frustrating. These judges, you know, he dealt with it in the right way, and I hope he held the guy in contempt.
Yeah, Justin.
And don't do court on Zoom. I don't know. It's bad enough we got to do meetings and all staffs and like all sorts of stuff.
Justin, maybe you've covered a lot of cases before. Have you seen any crazy anything out?
Yeah, I've seen that in a courtroom where people get mad, but I've never seen that kind of language. And frankly, I've not seen it on Zoom, especially, you know, when they do the Zoom, and you guys know this, there's a million boxes open. That's what it took a second to figure out who was swearing. I mean, that's the way it is, I guess, with 2026 law.
Mr. Yeah. Bogus got his name mispronounced like three times in that, apparently, too. I don't know. There was a different name every time.
Yeah, the judge used angrier and angrier versions of the name as it continued. But let's finish off with a question to get to know our guests a little bit. How about we talked about Ben Affleck and the Matt Damon movie. How about your favorite movie? Not The Rip that we talked about, but your favorite Affleck or Damon or Affleck and Damon movie. Let's start with Dave Ring. This guy's been making movies for, 30 years almost.
I'm not going to go like all time. I'm going to go in the last 6 months.
Oh.
Crime 101. It was in the theaters recently. It's the great heist movie. It's written. The book was written by this guy, Don Winslow, who's a phenomenal crime fiction writer. Go see it. It's awesome.
But wait, that's neither an Affleck nor a Damon movie.
Oh, it has to be an Affleck or Damon movie? I missed that part.
Just name your favorite movie.
Sorry. I blew that one. Well, just assume they're in it. I don't know.
Okay. Making up his own category. Ryan Burrow, favorite Damon or Affleck or Damon and Affleck? They probably made what? 8 or 9 movies together,
yeah. Born Identity. I love that. I love that series. You know, it's interesting because he's got Matt Damon hosted SNL this week, and he's got Odyssey coming out, which should be really interesting. I'm excited. You know, one thing I leaned over and I told my wife, I said, you know, when Saving Private Ryan, you know how they age him? You know how they age the Matt Damon character? I'm trying to see if it's getting close because, I mean, he's been in the industry for a while. Think about when they age him to being, you know, at the gravesite. And I'm trying to think, like, they did a pretty good job, actually, as he's kind of aged because he's got to be in his 50s now at this point, right? Late 40s, early 50s. So, all right.
The Odyssey by Homer. What's Homer's last name? Do we know? Or is it Homer's last name? We don't know. Justin, your favorite Affleck or Damon movie?
I wasn't a huge fan of Good Will Hunting. I know that's a weird take to say, but that made him famous. I enjoyed Matt Damon.
It's not your fault.
Yeah. Was it The Informant? The Archer's Dan and Midland movie? He was great in that. And I did like both of them in the, and I'm terrible with names of movies, but the one about Nike signing Michael
Air.
Air. That was interesting. And I thought they played different than they usually do.
Okay. Well, Dave's thinking.
I'll go back. I'll play the game right. I'll make it quick. The Talented Mr. Ripley with Matt Damon was a great movie.
Oh yeah. How's the peeping? Great line by Philip Seymour Hoffman. Tina, favorite Affleck or Damon movie?
Well, I was gonna say Good Will Hunting, but I know you like to, you know, shake it up. So I will throw out a movie that no one mentioned, which is He's Just Not That Into You, which was many years ago, but had a really good cast. There were a lot of people in that movie that are pretty famous.
Hey, Marella, do you know who these people are? And do you have a favorite movie of them? They're a little bit before your time.
I can't say I do. Don't flame me, but I haven't watched too many Matt Damon or Ben Affleck movies, which, you know, I know what I'm going to be doing this weekend now.
I have one, though. Reindeer Games.
Oh, Reindeer Games. Charlize Theron. Yeah, good one. I love The Town, right? Great crime movie. Seen it many times. I also love Affleck is in about 10 minutes of Boiler Room, which is kind of a take of Glengarry Glen Ross, which is the greatest movie ever made. So if you haven't seen Boiler Room or The Town, go watch them right away.
Nobody picked We Bought a Zoo.
No. Cameron Crowe. Lots of not movies to choose. The one other really underrated movie, actually a legal movie, is Changing Lanes. You ever see Changing Lanes? Ben Affleck and Samuel L. Jackson. They start the movie in a car. They have a road rage thing, and he's a lawyer, and it just kind of devolves from there. It's a great movie.
You know, it's crazy. I'm going through. I just typed up the list. It's amazing how many of these I had on DVD. How many of these movies are in DVD? You know, I mean, it's right. Something this next generation would have. Dogma. Dogma's another one. Right. I think I had that on DVD. Ocean's 11. That was on DVD. I had that. So
Dazed really and Confused.
What was the John Grisham movie that Damon was in?
Rainmaker.
Great movie.
Good stuff. All right. So let's put a bow on this one. Thank you so much, Justin Kaufman and David Rain, for joining us. That'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face Off on WGN. Special thanks to Professor Atiba Ellis of Case Western University School of Law, Professor Jill Fish, University of Pennsylvania, and Illinois State Senator Sue Rezin. Also, shout out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stiegel, for Tina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and...